Yeah, it's ready. Debbie, which one is it? The middle one? Can you guys hear me? Yes, no, maybe. Can you hear me? Can you guys hear me? Maybe I have to make it louder. How about now? Well, that sounds very loud. How about now? Okay. I guess it's different if we're talking or not. All right. So I'm Alice Heiklin, and I'm going to come and talk to you about development. So a lot of what Dr. Moshowitz has talked to you about is how cells function or how they work in general. And we call that primarily physiology. Development's a little different because it really talks to you about how an organism is built. Okay? So how it actually develops over time from one cell to numerous types of cells. Some people who are more lumpers would say there's anywhere between 200 to 250 different cell types. Those that are splitters, you know, those who like to make lots of different categories, would tell you that there are millions of cell types. It really depends on what, you know, how you feel, but everybody agrees that you start with one and you get at least hundreds of different types. Let's not forget that all of those hundreds of different types all contain in the same individual the same DNA. So that's kind of our starting point. I will also state that one of the primary ways that we get those different cells is through differences in transcription. And so today I'm going to talk about transcription. And next week, I will talk about, then once we have that foundation of transcription, I will talk about cell fate determination. How does each cell become, let's say, a cell in the liver or a cell in the heart? Or and what makes them different? What's the difference between those two cells? Okay? So I'll talk about what we call cell fate determination on Tuesday. Then, once we've kind of got that under our belt, and we will talk about not only the liver and the heart, I will just kind of mention ahead of time, we'll also talk about stem cells, which is a very special type of cell type, right? So we'll talk about those too, which of course makes it very interesting. You'll hear about that a lot in the news. So we'll try to unravel some of that. And then I will take as my example of cell fate determination and give you one example of a system. I will use as my example sex determination. How do we become males or females? And you'll see as we go along that even though we like to call ourselves males or females, there's also a lot of options in between. Okay. So let's start off. If you look at the handout, 9A. I know that Dr. Moshowitz many times uses a second line on top for you to know it's DNA. Just because I want things to be clear, I'm actually going to draw just one line, but do realize that this is double-stranded DNA. Okay? So, here we have a piece of double-stranded DNA in the genome. This piece of DNA exists in every single cell of your body, right? And I'm going to use this one just as an example, and I will tell you that I'm going to start talking now about the regions that control the expression of this gene or its transcription. But realize that I am, in order to present this, really generalizing. So as we go along during class today, I'm going to start broadening out and mentioning more specifics. But I will start off very general, okay? So very general. So first of all, in order to do that, I need to talk some terminology. So in general, we put an arrow to denote the beginning of transcription, and we call that plus one. And anything that then is going downstream from that, right? This would be where, you know, you'd get transcription off of this and you'd start the mRNA. So the plus one would be actually the nucleotide that gets capped, okay? So you start transcription, and this is then what we call downstream. And anything that's downstream is positive. On the other hand, anything that's going upstream is negative. Yes, there is no zero base. So we go from plus one to minus one. Okay? Now, we have first what we call the basal promoter, and it's a region here. It goes from plus 10, or 10 base pairs downstream of the initiation site for transcription, to about 25 base pairs upstream. And so you'll notice that I've mentioned the 25 because it's upstream is a minus, and the 10 because it's downstream is a plus. Okay? Now, one more thing that I need to mention, and that is that I mentioned here that plus one is the first nucleotide that gets transcribed. It really depends if you are a person who is very transcription-oriented, like myself, or if you're someone who is very translation-oriented. They sometimes, when you read articles, will say that the first nucleotide to encode for an amino acid is plus one, right? So the ATG. So you do have to be careful that sometimes you will get people that call the first nucleotide, the first codon that encodes for an amino acid, that first nucleotide of that first codon, or the A, they'll call plus one. So you just have to be sure that you understand whether we're talking transcription or translation. From my discussions, I will always refer to plus one as the plus one of transcription, so the first nucleotide in the mRNA. Okay? All right. So, this basal promoter is the region that will be associated with RNA polymerase 2, okay? In my discussion, I will talk only about RNA polymerase 2. Dr. Marshall would specify that in eukaryotes, we actually have three different polymerases for RNA. The RNA polymerase 2 is the one that transcribes mRNAs, and that's what I'm interested in. So whenever I refer to it, I'll always be referring to polymerase 2 in this case, okay? But I will specify already, okay, that the RNA polymerase does not bind the DNA itself, okay? But we'll get to what actually happens. But it is in this region, okay? In addition to that, we have some elements upstream, but they're relatively close, and we call them proximal regulatory elements. Now, your book, like Beckert, defines that as minus 100 to minus 200. So I will go with that, even though I would say that that's entirely too stringent, that, you know, the proximal region is going to be a little bit larger than that. But that is what is defined in your book, so I will go with that. In fact, maybe I should make it closer. I'll put it up here. And then there's a third type here, which we call the distal regulatory elements. And they can be, kilobases away from the region that is transcribed. So they can be, let's say, 2 kb, 10 kb, 30 kb, 100 kb away. Okay? And they can be either excitatory, so they can be either enhancing transcription or silencing transcription. And in fact, these regions that are upstream, we frequently call these distal regulatory elements, we frequently will call enhancers. Now, enhancers were originally defined in viruses, and they were thought to have three characteristics. So, they were that they could be located pretty much anywhere relative to the gene, so location independent. Another interesting characteristic is you could flip them, and it doesn't matter their orientation. So they are orientation independent. And the third thing that was involved in their definition was that they could work upstream of any basal promoter. It didn't have to be their own. So, basal promoter independent. So we saw that enhancers, this is how it was originally defined. Usually enhancers and viruses are very strong. They want to get into a cell and just make as much of themselves as possible. Okay? That's not true of eukaryotic enhancers. Yes, they want to drive expression, but they usually want to do it in a regulated way. And so frequently enhancers and eukaryotes fulfill some of these requirements, but most of them don't fulfill all three. So just realize that even though this was how this was originally defined, now for eukaryotic enhancers, most of them do not fulfill all three requirements. Okay? Okay, now something else. We have about, in our genome, about 25,000 genes. Maybe 30,000, depending on who you talk to. It's thought now that we have about 1 million enhancers. So if you do the math, that's definitely not one gene. So I've simplified a little bit here, but you can imagine what that means, that these regions that regulate transcription are very complex. Okay? So I'd like to now, though, just for a moment, compare this, what we've talked about now, to what was going on in prokaryotes, which you talked about last semester. So if you look in the middle of handout 9A, if we look at this. So first I have to say also, I have to do some definitions. So we've got what we call cis and trans elements, okay? Cis elements are those pieces of the DNA connected to that gene. So the DNA itself, the various regulatory elements. So that would include the basal promoter, the proximal regulatory elements, and the distal regulatory elements or enhancers or silencers. Okay, so now one thing I need to, and those are cis. One thing I need to say also before I go on, another part was that's connected to terminology. So depending on where you're reading it, some people refer to the promoter as all of the regulatory elements. So it would include the basal, the proximal, and the distal elements. And some people refer to the promoter as being just this basal promoter. So be careful, once again, people may switch back and forth. Okay? So, we've talked about the various pieces we've talked about until now are all cis. Okay? So this is in eukaryotes. And we have the core or basal promoter. And then we have the control elements. And within them, we have two types. We have proximal, and we have distal. And once again, these can be divided into two types: enhancers and silencers. So now, I didn't actually mention it until now, but so the enhancers, as the name says, enhances transcription. The silencer, as the name implies, silences transcription. But how did they really figure that out? So when they were figuring that out, they actually did it by deleting those sequences and looking to see what happens. Okay? So if you would delete an enhancer, you would lose expression. If you would delete a silencer, okay, you would have expression all the time. Okay, how about prokaryotes? And I'm going to make a line here so I can get to it. So in prokaryotes, you would have the promoter, which would be equivalent to this core promoter. And you would have the operator. Okay, now I've told you that this, all these cis elements, are the same in every cell. So that doesn't really solve our problem. How do we make, from one cell, 200 different types? There's got to be more to this puzzle, okay? And so that's where the transcription factors or the trans elements come in. So before we go on, we have to define a transcription factor. So a transcription factor binds the DNA. And it either increases or decreases transcription, which I abbreviate T-script. And the transcription factors work as proteins. So these are proteins, as opposed to the cis factor, which was DNA. So in prokaryotes, we've already come across such a thing, the repressor. How about in eukaryotes? Okay, so I've kind of given this away, transcription factors, of course. But we have more than one type of transcription factor. We have the basal transcription factors, which you can probably already guess bind to the basal promoter, and the regulatory transcription factors, which would bind to all the other elements that I've spoken about, both the proximal and the distal regulatory elements. And you can have then both activators or repressors. Now you'll notice that here I primarily mentioned in prokaryotes repressors, and that's primarily what is going on, okay, is common, is to have primarily repression, and only when you get a stimulus to relieve that repression does transcription change. In eukaryotes, primarily you need to have an activator to turn on a gene. So their primary mode of working is a little different. So, the trick board. You have to hold it down for a little while. Let's see if I can do it like this. Okay, so. Okay. Sometimes the toughest part is just the apparatus in the room. Okay. So, if we try to then, you know, differentiate between our cis and our trans. So, our cis works on only the DNA that it's connected to. But as I mentioned, it can be really far away. In fact, we'll get to then how it has any effect on transcription if it's so far away. Okay? I will tell you that, you know, when I was doing my postdoc, I did it on a promoter of a gene, happened to be called GATA4, doesn't matter. And the promoter that I was looking for to drive its expression in heart was 15 kilobase away. I spent almost a year looking for it, okay? So, you know, and do realize that when I said it was location independent, that it could be anywhere. It can be upstream of the gene. It can be downstream of the gene, right, of the where the mRNA is transcribed. And it can be in between in an intron. So when I say location independent, I mean really it could be anywhere relative to the gene. Okay, so just keep that in mind. So the cis elements work on the DNA they're attached to, even though it may be really frustrating and really far away. Or it could work on the targets that it can bind to, so on its various targets. And we've already given some examples. Promoter or basal promoter for both eukaryotes and prokaryotes. The operator for prokaryotes. And the enhancer in eukaryotes. And here, this would be the transcription factor, the protein, which obviously comes from DNA, right? So we're talking about then the transcription factor that gets both transcribed and translated and goes to a different target that it binds to. Remember, transcription factors bind DNA, and each of them binds to a specific sequence. And then the control element. And it has binding sites for the transcription factors. So it has binding sites which consists of sequence on the DNA. And then the transcription factor would bind that sequence. Okay, so let me give you an example of that last one for the binding site. One of the classic examples is that one of the binding sites that exists inside of the basal promoter is a binding site for one of the basal transcription factors, and the name of its binding site, we call it the TATA box. So any thoughts as to why the TATA box? Didn't hear? Go ahead. Okay. So it's not just, these are actually the nucleotides to which the protein binds. But this is really what we call a consensus sequence. Okay, so what does that mean? So we call it the Tata box, and its sequence, T-A-T-A-A-A, we would say is its consensus sequence. And what does that mean? That it is most likely to have a T at the beginning, and most likely to have its second nucleotide be an A, and most likely to have its third be a T. Okay? But not always. So it's what it's most likely to be, but isn't always. Okay? And all of the various transcription factors bind to specific sequences that have a little bit of fluctuation, but there is a sequence that they prefer or most, you know, bind to most frequently. Okay? So, I'm going to draw that out again and to talk about it. So let's say if we draw out this piece of DNA, we need to, once again, this would be its plus one, and this would be its basal promoter with its various proximal elements. And somewhere, upstream, downstream, in between, you will have enhancers. To make things simple, I'm just going to draw one enhancer or distal element. And you can see this, what I'm drawing is actually on 9B at the top. And what we're going to see is that various transcription factors will bind to this distal regulatory element. Here they've drawn two that look the same, but they most definitely do not have to be the same. And so these transcription factors would bind to the DNA. Now, this would be in a response to a signal. Okay? So there'd be a signal that occurs in the cell that causes these transcription factors to either be activated. They may already be in the cell, so just activated, but it may also be that this signal causes them to actually be transcribed and translated. But regardless, as a result of this signal, they're accessible in the nucleus and they bind to this sequence. This then causes various chromatin modifications or remodeling, which Dr. Moshowitz spoke about on Tuesday. And so what we see is that as a result of these transcription factors binding, we have a change in the configuration of the chromosome. Okay? Now, one thing that I should mention, just to kind of attach what she was saying to what I'm talking about now, is that usually many of the hypersensitive sites, those sites that were eaten up by the DNase, right, in those experiments that Dr. Moshowitz described, those loosest regions or those hypersensitive sites that weren't covered by histones but rather were covered by proteins would be these enhancers. So this is a hypersensitive site or loosest. Just to remind you about her categories, so within euchromatin, so heterochromatin is one thing. Those are regions that are kept silent and not transcribed. Then we have euchromatin, which is transcribed. But some of those regions are not transcribed at the moment. They are kept as loose. Then within those genes that are transcribed, we have two categories. As far as their large region around them, we call the locus. We have the region that is the enhancers that are covered by proteins and not nucleosomes. We call those loosest. And then we have the region around transcription. And as the transcription is going on, this region here would be called looser. So within this same region, that's the gene with all its regulatory elements, but that's active, we have both looser, where the exons and introns are that are being transcribed, and we have enhancers that are loosest. Okay? So, Now we have another question, and that is, what happens first? Do the transcription factors come in first and bind to their sites, and as a result, that loosens up the chromatin, which is what they show in figure on the handout 2B. That's what they show. They show that then we get various modifying enzymes that come in and loosen up the chromatin so we can start transcription. And that is what happens some of the time, we think. But some of the time it's also thought that first the modifiers come in and then that makes access for the transcription factors. So it doesn't seem that it's always the same, or it may also be just that we haven't really, that we really need to totally figure it out. So which comes first is a great question. But in our example, we've had first the transcription factors bind, and then we have some chromatin modifiers. So if these are our... try to keep this consistent. I'll draw the same way as the picture. So if this, right, was our distal control element or enhancer, and as a result, they bind to various chromatin modifiers or chromatin remodelers, right? And as a result of those changes, we now recruit in the transcription machinery. So what do we need in order to get that transcription? So let's look at that. So we have the basal promoter, okay? And it turns out that RNA polymerase 2 does not bind directly to the DNA. That it has a whole bunch of transcription factors that it works with that actually bind the DNA, and then RNA polymerase binds to it. And it's thought that the first one that comes in, I know that Dr. Moshowitz mentioned that they are TF for transcription factor 2 because they work with RNA polymerase 2. A, B, C, D, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't even know what letter they've gotten up to. Okay? The first one that's thought to bind is D. And D is actually a complex of proteins rather than being one protein. So in that complex, one of the proteins is called TATA binding protein. So if anybody remembers from the previous board, I've just told you that there is a TATA box. Anybody have any guesses who binds the TATA box? The TATA binding protein. Okay? So it usually comes in and finds the TATA binding protein. I will stipulate that not all promoters have a TATA box, and so there are some that are binding a little differently. But for those who do have the TATA box, the TATA binding protein, which is in this TF2D complex, binds to the TATA box. When it does that, it actually manages to bend the DNA. Once that binds here, I'll just write D, okay, a whole bunch of its friends start to bind with it. Okay? And I'm just going to write them as circles because I do not care that you know the letters. Okay? On the handout, there are letters. Only the D is important because it has TATA binding protein. So these, what happens then is, so these activators that came in here because they were bound to this enhancosome came in and they bound to various factors, including some cofactors like mediator, which you'll see here. As a result of this, we had the TF2D bind together with all its friends, and once they do that, they then recruit polymerase 2. And so by the time we're done, right, so the order would be this. In this case, we have first transcription factors binding to the distal enhancer. Then we have that the chromatin is modified, so things loosen up, and so we can get in and start binding. Okay, instead of having your... So you need to get that you have to the point of beads on a string in this looser area in order for us to access the region. Okay? So we've got the chromatin modified. Then those activators bind to co-activators like mediator. And why is it called a co-activator? Because it does not itself bind to the DNA. If you remember, by definition, transcription factors bind the DNA. So both these activators, which are transcription factors, and these basal transcription factors are all binding the DNA. Mediator is not, and RNA polymerase 2 is not. Okay? So once you form this big complex, you then start to get transcription. So we've kind of answered one of the questions which I posed, and that is, how does those enhancers that are very far away activate transcription? Well, it's thought that there's a couple of ways, but that the example I'm going to give you, or the classic way that's thought, is by looping the DNA. Right? As opposed to them being right nearby and just being able to affect the complex, you've actually looped the DNA. Well, this kind of, you know, lets us understand why orientation is not important. Because if it's so far away, when it comes and loops around, it can lay whichever way it wants. So orientation no longer really makes a difference. You can imagine also that once it's a certain distance away, location doesn't matter either. What difference does it make if it's upstream or way downstream and would loop up and join with the basal promoter? Okay. So I've told you that all of this has happened, and now we start to have transcription. And so we like to categorize categorize the steps in transcription as four steps. The first one is that Pol II binds. The second is initiation. Three, elongation, and four, termination. And now someone may say to me, well, that's pretty obvious. The reason I bother to actually state those four steps is because I want you to realize that in the cell, all four of them can be regulated. So you could have RNA polymerase bind, but not initiate. You could have it initiate, but not elongate. And you could have it elongate, but not terminate. So you can regulate all of these steps. So all of these steps can be regulated. All right. So I've spent a lot of time talking to you about how we get transcription. So what is the connection to developmental biology? Why, you know, that's my thing, right? So why am I busy talking about it? Okay? So the truth is that the difference between those 200 or a million different types of cells, depending on who you are, a lumper or a splitter, is not the DNA in the cell, because every cell has the same DNA. Rather, the mRNA, or the difference in transcription, in each cell. So if I have three cell types, liver, lung, and heart, that I chose randomly, liver and lung will share some mRNAs, heart and lung will share some, and heart and liver will share some. But they'll also have some that are unique. So heart has some unique mRNAs and so proteins, and liver has some unique mRNAs and so protein, and lung is the same. There's one little category that I didn't mention yet, and those are the ones that are shared by all. Okay? And those then we call, when they're shared by all, we call them ubiquitous, meaning they're all over the place. And we call this special set of genes housekeeping genes. Now, these are really genes that have to do with, for example, metabolism, to keep all the cells going, or structure, to keep the structure of all cells. Okay? One of the things that's a little confusing is I've called them genes, and yet I'm really interested in the proteins they produce, right? Because I'm talking about their differences. So usually when we talk about mRNA, right? But we do call them housekeeping genes, even though what's actually interesting in the end for the cell is the protein. So not to be confused by the name. So I've told you that there are different mRNAs in every cell type. Some they share, but lots they don't. So how do I get different mRNAs in different cells? Well, as development continues, each cell gets different signals, turning on different transcription factors, finding different enhancers in different cells, and so causing transcription of different genes. So there was some signal that happened up here that caused these transcription factors to become active. And so as development proceeds from one cell, lots of signals are affecting the transcription in each cell. Now, this is done in many different ways, but there are a few principles that I'd like to bring up. The first one, and I've listed them on the board, is combinatorial, coordinate, and then modular. And I'll go through these three. But I have to kind of lay the ground rules to start. So first of all, in general, you almost never have an element, like a distal element like this, or even a proximal element, that only binds one transcription factor. It is almost always, you need multiple transcription factors to activate. And so, for example, it's not that you need one transcription factor for every gene that you want turned on. That would mean you would need 25,000 transcription factors, and you definitely don't have that many, right? Because you got 25,000 genes. If it was a one-to-one, that's what you'd have to have. But it isn't. It's actually a combinatorial effect. So, for example, if I have six different genes in the cell, and I have three different binding sites, so I should make a little key. This is the binding site for transcription factor A. This is the binding site for transcription factor B. And this is the binding site for transcription factor C. So, in order to turn on the first gene, I only need A, and I will get transcription. Now, before I do that, I should define that this is one regulatory element. Okay, so that's a regulatory element. And I will tell you that I have simplified a little bit, and I've put here two binding sites, but do realize that a lot of these control elements have anywhere from, usually there's not less than three, up to it could be even 12, right? So that it's pretty complex. And you've got to get the right signals to turn on all three of those at the same time to get this gene on. So, let's go back to our example. So here we needed only A. Oh, my mistake. Here, because of course I need both A and B. A plus B. Number three, what am I going to need? Okay. A plus C. How about number four? How about number five? So only B. And number six. Only C. So what it means is that six different, it's enough to have three transcription factors, and I can turn on six different genes. So, in other words, the right combination of transcription factors will turn on a specific gene. Okay, so that's the first principle that I want to talk about. The second one is coordinate control. If you remember in prokaryotes, genes in a specific pathway were all linked together on this, and were polycistronic, all together and regulated together. So, and this, this table is actually in your notes, if you're interested, so you don't have to worry about getting work, you know, copying it down. So the coordinated control, okay, is linked in eukaryotes. It is not on the same region, okay? It could even be on different chromosomes in very different areas. So it's unlinked. The mRNA here is polycistronic. In prokaryotes, we have, oh, well, we have operons, and here we do not. The control element. Okay, we have one per operon. Whereas here, one per gene. And then something I alluded to at the beginning, control, okay, is frequently negative in that you frequently have a repressor, for example, sitting on the operon, and only when lactose shows up, it comes off. Here, the control is primarily positive. So you have a signal like heat stress, and it enables, it activates the transcription factor, enables it to go into the nucleus and activate some genes. So what would it look like in eukaryotes? If these are two different regions on the chromosome that are both activated as a result of heat shock, they would both have a distal element that would look similar. And as a result of heat shock, bind the same transcription factors that got activated, and so be activated together so that these two, and it's probably not two, it's more like eight or nine, whatever it is that's needed now to respond to the heat shock, will be transcribed simultaneously. And so this is then coordinate control. So it ends up with the same end result, but the way things are controlled is different. so my last example now gets a little bit more complicated, okay? So, okay, before I start erasing this, I just want to kind of now talk to you about... So I've talked until now, I've been speaking about how one distal regulatory element works. And there are a lot of structural genes or genes that are turned on and stay on that work pretty much in that way. But there's a whole other category of genes that are regulated tissue specifically, so let's say only in the heart, or temporally. So they're regulated at a certain time in development, but not at others. And those genes frequently have more than one distal enhancer and sometimes many, okay? And so it becomes a little bit more complicated when there are multiple distal enhancers, and we start to call that then what we call modules, because a certain stimulus, let's say heat shock, will turn on the gene, okay, in certain cells. You know, that's not the best example because that would turn it on in most cells. Let's give a different example. In fact, you know what I'll do is I'll use the example that we have here just to not confuse us at the bottom of 9B. Okay? So let me give you an example here. Oh. But just realize that these are, what I really need to say is what these are the more regulated proteins will have multiple distal enhancers. So transcription factors themselves, which I know we like to talk about them as proteins, they also come from DNA. Their regulation is very complex. And they usually have multiple enhancers that drive their expression in multiple cell types. So this would be one of those regulated proteins that you can see here at the bottom of 9B, and I've just written, and I may need even more room, and I've just called it gene X, but when I was doing it, I was actually thinking of a gene called PAX6, which is a transcription factor and is expressed in the pancreas, in the lens, and but not in neuronal cells. Actually, that's not true. It is expressed in neuronal cells, but for my example. I mean, I shouldn't even give you, since it's not real, I shouldn't even tell you the name, so I didn't say that. But the idea is that there's one signal to turn it on in the pancreas. There's a different signal to turn it on in the lens. Okay, and so that first signal that turns on in the pancreas activates a certain set of transcription factors, and the stimulus turn on the lens activates a different set of transcription factors, and that's what I'm going to show you now at the bottom of 9B. Okay, so what is very important to me here is that I've got three different cell types, and I want it to be incredibly clear that in each of them I have the exact same DNA for this gene. Gene X. So, nothing has changed, and this is pancreas. So, things are small, so not everything looks distal, but let's pretend those are both distal control elements, okay? DNA looks the same. We've got pancreas, lens, and neuron. So we get signal to turn on in the pancreas. So I'm just going to, call it signal Q. Turns on or activates circle and star. And so when it does that, okay, this signal was given to a cell in the pancreas and we got circle and star. We got activation of this gene in the pancreas. Now, it turns out that there happens to be also that same binding site for circle on the enhancer that drives expression in the lens. And so it's going to bind here too. But there's not enough, because you need more than one transcription factor, okay, to actually, because it's going to bind here, right? Well, it's not going to, this is a little confusing. So it would bind here. Let's get to the next example, and then I'll talk about what exactly happens. Okay, so that's according to stimulus Q. Now let's talk about what happens when you get stimulus S, okay? And now you'll have... hexagon, circle, and triangle. Okay? And so we have the circle binding again. Hexagon and triangle. And so as a result, you will get also activation, but as a response to a different signal, signal S, in the lens. Because, of course, the signals that the pancreas are exposed to are not going to be the same as the signals the lens is exposed to. And then here, where we aren't exposed to either of those signals, we will not get activation in the neuron. So just realize that the same protein can be driven in different cell types as a result of different stimuli. And this is usually true of various regulatory proteins that are expressed in different cell types or at different times. So instead of using different cell types, I could have done different periods in development. Okay? Questions for me? Yeah?
Are those each separate genes, or are one is the control elements and is one the actual promoting elements?
So this is all gene X, right? But in each, I'm just showing you the locus of that DNA in one cell, in a second cell, and in a third cell. It's all the same DNA. Did I answer your question? No. So what?
So what does each box represent?
A distal regulatory element.
Okay. So it's distal and then the basal.
So the basal I haven't even drawn, but this would be the basal. You know, I have a problem with space. Like, I couldn't draw it out as big, so I haven't. But there would be your basal control element, your basal promoter. And these are distal control elements.
Okay, so the most activated?
No, you mean because it's 3 instead of 2?
Well, it just seems like it's just, like, more crowded. I don't know.
So, no. It's activated here, and it's activated here. Not activated in the third one. So I should write here. Yes? Yes? No? Okay? Yeah?
But any one of those signals would activate it in any one of those cell types. So if the neuron were exposed to signal S or Q, it would be activated.
Right, but it wouldn't be exposed to S or Q.
Right.
Because of its, you know, placement and, you know, it's, right.
But it has a mechanism.
Sure does. Because, right, you can't change the DNA. Right? What you're changing is what transcription factors are on to activate it, to change that gene X's transcription. Yep.
Would the circles be the same thing for Q and S, or would they be two different?
So in this case, I wanted it to be the same, on purpose to show you that there can be some overlap, and that just having the circle on, right, it does not mean that you've totally activated this element. Yeah.
When you're saying it, exposed to the signal, you're saying that each signal is composed of these transcription factors. Is that what you're saying?
The signal would be a paracrine signal, for example. So during development, I know you've talked about paracrines. During development, there's all kinds of paracrine signals that different cells are exposed to different paracrine signals. As a result, they activate a signaling cascade that would either activate or actually cause the transcription and translation of different transcription factors.
Because you're saying that the signal itself is made up of these transcription factors where, like you're saying, there's some overlap. Different signals have some of the same elements of the transcription factors? I mean, that's what seems to be, you're saying, like with the circle. Is that correct? Is that what you're saying?
So two different signals, signal S and Q, could activate some of the same transcription factors. But it wouldn't be enough, right? Because you need actually the combination of hexagon, circle, and triangle to activate in LEMS.
So you're saying that the signal...
So for example, if LEMS received signal Q, that would not be enough to activate it in LEMS. Yeah.
When the cell receives the signal, does the signal sort of conformationally change the TF so it can then bind to, or sort of how does the signal activate?
Okay, so there's a number of different ways. One of the ways is actually that. It actually changes the configuration of the transcription factor, or it modifies the transcription factor. Let's say it adds phosphorylation or removes phosphorylation, which enables it to go into the nucleus and bind DNA. That's a classic example where you add or subtract phosphorylation. Another one is that you change its configuration, enabling it to go into the nucleus and bind the DNA. Yeah?
Hi. So if the pancreas and lens are both exposed to the same signal Q, and it's the same DNA, why is the star not attached in the lens?
Because they wouldn't be exposed to the same signal.
But a circle attaches.
Right, but a circle's not enough. Yeah?
Would you still involve its location and dependence? Does that go so far as to say one chromosome could be regulating something happening on another chromosome, or must it always be on the same chromosome?
Same chromosome. So cis elements need to stay on the same chromosome. It's complicated enough. We don't need to make it worse. Now, okay, so if you have further questions, feel free to ask me later. I want to actually show you something. So one moment. Okay. Is that enough, or I need to make it even lower?
That's fine.
Okay. All right. So, a lot of forensics in the news. We find three organs in the backyard. Okay? How do we know if these organs are three different people or belong to the same person? What do you guys think? Okay, so you check the DNA. Okay, so the DNA tests show that all three organs come from the same individual. What would be different between them? So let's say, for example, now you wanted to know So what would be the difference between, right, the DNA, let's say, is the same. What if it was two people Now let's start with, okay, what if it was one person? What would be different? Okay, let's take a vote. Okay. Anybody who wants A? Okay, which would be DNA and RNA? Okay, nobody, almost nobody. Okay, how about D? Okay. How about C? How about D? E? And F? Okay, so our overall winning answer was B. And yes, hopefully after my lecture, it would be very obvious to you that the difference was RNA and protein. Okay. Now, what I'd like to do, and I know that there's issues with the differences in volume, so I'm going to show you a film about chromatin compaction. And what I'd... wait a second. What I'd like to stress to you is that in addition to, as you all said, that it's RNA and protein that are different, do realize that there's going to also be a difference in chromatin compaction between cells of different genes. And I will continue with that next week when I talk about how each cell determines its fate, because we will have differences in both mRNA, so the transcription, but also in the chromatin compaction. And then when I'm done with development, Dr. Moshowitz will talk about how you can then modify the transcript once it is made, and how you can also modify the proteins. But I will continue next week with the transcription and the chromatin compaction and how they kind of work together. So kind of to give you an idea of what Dr. Moshowitz was talking about how they become compact and how they work, I'm going to show you a movie about that. I would like you, because we will talk about how these, I know that she talked about the tails of the histones, and even though when you think of tail, you think of the end, we're actually talking about, it could either be the end terminus or the C terminus of the tails get modified, and you'll see how they're busy sticking out and could easily be modified by various proteins when the chromatin is open. So I'd like you to take a look at that. You will also get a chance to see chromatin condensing in mitosis, so please make sure to look for that because I think it's pretty cool. Okay. And I apologize if it's really loud, so let's see what happens. Oh. Wait a moment. I'm still on my mic. One moment. Do you know how to switch to the regular mic?
We'll see the remarkable way our DNA is tightly packed up to fit into the nucleus of every cell. The process starts with assembly of a nucleosome, which is formed when 8 separate histone protein subunits attach to the DNA molecule. The combined tight loop of DNA and protein is the nucleosome. Multiple nucleosomes are coiled together, and these then stack on top of each other. The end result is a fiber of packed nucleosomes known as chromatin.
See all the tails?
This fiber, which at this point is condensed to a thickness of 30 nanometers, is then looped and further packaged using other proteins which are not shown here. This remarkable multiple folding allows 6 feet of DNA to fit into the nucleus of each cell in our body, an object so small that 10,000 nuclei could fit on the tip of a needle. The end result is that the DNA is tightly packed into the familiar structures we can see through a microscope, chromosomes. It is important to realize that chromosomes are not always present. They form only when cells are dividing. At other times, as you can see here at the end of cell division, our DNA becomes less highly organized.
Yeah, let me run it one more time, because it is very cool, in my opinion.
Are you
going to
post it?
Sure.
In this animation, we'll see the remarkable way our DNA is tightly packed up to fit into the nucleus of every cell. The process starts with assembly of a nucleosome, which is formed when 8 separate histone protein subunits attach to the DNA molecule. The combined tight loop of DNA and protein is the nucleosome. Multiple nucleosomes are coiled together, and these then stack on top of each other. The end result is a fiber of packed nucleosomes known as chromatin. This fiber, which at this point is condensed to a thickness of 30 nanometers, is then looped and further packaged using other proteins which are not shown here. This remarkable multiple folding allows 6 feet of DNA to fit into the nucleus of each cell in our body, an object so small that 10,000 nuclei could fit on the tip of a needle. The end result is that the DNA is tightly packed into the familiar structures we can see through a microscope, chromosomes. It is important to realize that chromosomes are not always present. They form only when cells are dividing.
Was the recorder?
At other times, as you can see here at the end of cell division,